The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by Fulfill.io, the ERP built natively for e-commerce sellers. Fulfill streamlines the complexity in your business to save you time and money. From smart order routing to warehouse management, accounting to inventory tracking, they take all of your complexity and all the things that take a lot of time and manual effort and streamline them under one unified tool. Their clients range from seven-figure brands all the way through companies doing hundreds of millions of dollars per year so they can grow and scale with you. And they're the highest rated ERP in our community of private sellers, according to member reviews, scoring higher than Odoo, Skubana, Brightpearl, and yes, even NetSuite. Actually scored quite a bit higher than NetSuite. So if you want to streamline the complexity in your business, check them out at ecommercefuel.com/fulfill. The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by OneClick Upsell, the most popular, largest upsell app in the Shopify marketplace, trusted by over 11,000 users, over 1,900 of those big spending Shopify Plus stores, and they've generated over $200 million in revenue for the merchants that use them. And you may be thinking, oh, hey, Andrew, I've heard of OneClick Upsell. I know these guys, but do you really? Do you know what they've rolled out recently? They've got some cool new stuff. For their pre-purchase and their post-purchase upsells, you can now select from multiple different offers to present your customers. So instead of having them just have to pick from one single thing, you can give them the option to pick from multiple upsells, which helps and has proven to increase the number of people who actually take you up on those upsells. So if you're not using upsells in your store, it's an amazingly easy, fast way to increase your average order value and your revenues. So check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure e-commerce brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And if you have been on a college campus or out in the park or really out and about on a Sunday afternoon at some point in the last 3, 4, 5 years, you almost certainly have seen the product by today's guest. A game, it's almost like a little trampoline. There's four people hovered around it, and people diving, going crazy, usually with large grins on their faces, are enjoying the activity and each other. It's a game called Spike Ball, super popular on college campuses, but also just in parks and with the public in general. And it was founded by a guy named Chris Reuter, who is our guest today and going to be diving into this. And I love the story in the business because it's one of those things that may have looked like an overnight success, was not. It's something that relies a lot on community and connection, and not just, I'm guessing a lot of word of mouth, and just the way he's marketed and built this business is really unique and something I think that is going to become more and more important as we go forward, kind of in the way that digital is changing. So anyway, super excited. We met on Twitter. We were talking about that before, but Chris, thrilled to have you on, man. Thanks for being willing to do this.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. So you, quick little high-level trajectory, you started the business, I think, in late 2000s, 2007 or 8, and took 4 or 5 years to get to about $1 million in sales, and that happened in 2012 or 13. Is that approximately accurate?
Yep. Launched it in June of 08 and ran it for about 5 years on my own, but as a night job. So, to start the company, I raised about $100,000 of friends and family money. And, so didn't have any money to pay any full-time employees, let alone myself. So came home from my day job every day, hung out with wife and kids. They'd go to bed. And then from about 9 p.m. to maybe 1 or 2 a.m. every night was spike ball hours until 2013. And at that point, we hit $1 million of annual revenue with zero full-time employees. And then my wife and I agreed it was safe to quit the day job and go full-time.
Dang, man. So you were doing this for 5 years on the side. That's super impressive. How the money you raise from friends and family, I'm already going off script here, but I can't help but asking. I think a lot of founders would say that's either the worst thing that they have done or the best thing that they have done in their entrepreneurial career. Obviously it worked out for you. Was talk about that a little bit. Was that hard to do? Were there times like, what was the pain threshold / potential family relational dysfunction that was a fallout of that? Or was there zero? I think, cause that's something people think about a lot, but I think, and probably rightfully so, it's, fraught with problems as well.
Yeah, I mean, what's the line? It says something like you shouldn't do business with family or friends, and I did it with both. And yes, there definitely have been headaches, and there have been one or two friendships that did not survive. That sucks, but sometimes so goes life. Now, I don't even know, like, it never crossed my mind to try and raise money from like angel investors or like, quote, professional investors. If I would have tried that, I think I would have failed. You know, if you would have looked at my resume, like, you know, I've got a degree in photojournalism. I had been selling online advertising for Microsoft and Live Nation and other big companies. You know, I had zero experience, even remotely close to what was, I guess, a traditional investor would probably be looking for this sort of thing. So, number one, never crossed my mind. And two, yes, the $100,000 is what allowed us to start the company. I think maybe 40 of that 100,000 went to inventory, like our first 1,000 spike ball sets, if I remember right. But the real funding that does not show up on the spreadsheet is my day job. And, you know, at the time I was working for Microsoft. So, you know, Bill Gates does not know how critical he was in financing Spikeball in the early days. And I'm very appreciative. But by keeping that day job, I was able to still pay my mortgage, make sure that my family is being taken care of and all of that. And if Spikeball were to, you know, all of a sudden implode, the world wasn't going to end. I still had that.
Yeah. And this is, realize I'm kind of asking some personal questions, so feel free to be vague on the specifics. Maybe lessons is the best way. But what were, because you look at Spikeball now and, you know, wildly successful in terms of revenue and adoption and just brand. So, you know, when you think about those early investors, those friends and family around that it unfortunately kind of soured some relationships, is that's unfortunate. But also, you know, given the success, also kind of surprising. So any lessons, a lesson or two that came out of that in terms of things you do differently or a structure, something you'd structure differently, or what were the lessons out of those, that early friends and family around, despite the success, that you'd do differently next time?
I probably could have communicated better. None of us had an ounce of experience or anything close to what the business sort of needed. You know, it was just the reason they were there is because they wrote a check, not because they brought certain expertise to the business. And when we did, you know, raise that money, we did, you know, as we were sitting at, I think it was Casey's Tavern in Chicago, said, okay, guys, we're going to do this. And nobody's allowed to write a check for an amount larger than you're comfortable losing, because chances are very good you're going to lose it. We've never done this before. I, Chris, will be running the show, and I've never done this before. But worst case scenario, we had fun trying. So let's roll the dice and see. That's about as sophisticated as our analysis got. That got us off to a real sticky start, because, you know, I'm, you know, burning the midnight oil and doing tons of work. And some of the guys would do stuff, some wouldn't. And like, I was spending so much time trying to chase that down. And after enough time, you know, my brother pulled me aside and we had a good chat. And he said, Chris, what I think we're learning is that the rest of us, we want to be silent shareholders. And you seem way more excited about this than any of us, and way more willing to do sort of all the work. So maybe we can come up with a plan where that's what happens. And I loved it. And we eventually got to a plan where, you know, if I was going to be doing all the work and they were going to do nothing, you know, I needed to be compensated somehow, but the company didn't have any money. So we came up with, I forget, it was maybe a 3 or 4 year sales plan, something like that, where if the company hit certain sales targets, I would earn equity. If we didn't hit those, I earn nothing. So some of the guys liked that idea. Some like thought I was being greedy and just trying to take stuff over, even though the ink on our articles of incorporation was barely dry, but eventually got there. And that allowed me to, you know, it felt like I was going maybe 11 miles an hour and allowed me to go 90 miles an hour when I was, you know, purely a one-man show running this thing.
I want to talk about marketing a little bit, because I feel like you have this really great example of a very strong brand. Even if people don't know the name Spikeball, they've only certainly have seen it. And look, from the outside looking in, obviously I can't see your analytics and your dashboard. We haven't talked about it before, but I would guess when you think about marketing, word of mouth would drive a lot of it. Community, you do a lot of events. You do a lot of like free product giveaways to leaders, to people in you know, on college campuses, things like that. So I'd love to hear, like, how much of that is powering your brand and has powered your brand growth? And how much do you have to rely, or do you rely on paid traffic, SEO, those kind of things? Is it safe to say that community and word of mouth and strong brand really is the primary engine behind the growth of your business? Because I feel like that's something that is hard to do, takes a long time. Obviously, you've been at this since 2008, but so much more durable and kind of, I think, a new model we're going to see adopted more and more by people, kind of being willing to say like, hey, I have to do the long game. Paid traffic's harder. It's always shifting, kind of building a real brand, which you've done. So anyway, that was without knowing, is that accurate? Like, is that actually what's driving the brand, or are you guys also spending head over fist on paid traffic?
We spend next to nothing on paid traffic. So yes, organic is one of my favorite words in the world. And that is, I think, one of organic and authentic, I think, are the two best words to put towards our marketing style, towards our brand. And at least in our case, like, I believe our best form of marketing is somebody playing our game. Now, I don't have any data to prove that, right? Because let's say you buy a set, maybe you play 5 times a year, and somebody else buys that exact same set, and they play 50 times a year. I have no idea who's playing, how often, where, or when. Maybe you're playing in the backyard, but that other person is playing on a college campus in a very public area where a lot of people are walking by. So much more value. We get so much more value from that person that plays frequently and in a high foot traffic area. But you know, the other thing that we're fortunate in that is that our product has a viral element built into it. So one person buys it, and they now have to go recruit 3 friends to play. And then when they do go play, they're most likely playing on a college campus, at a beach, in a park, or someplace where a stranger is going to walk by. They're going to stop. They're going to look and they're going to kind of mouth to themselves, what's that weird trampoline game? If they're bold enough, they'll actually walk up and ask about it. Not more often than not, but what happens a lot of time is when that stranger comes up and asks, the people already playing invites that person to play with them. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard this story where that happens, and then the stranger plays for like 3 hours with them. And then at the end of it, the person that owns the spikeball set literally gives it to the stranger for free, just as a thanks for coming by and wants them to have a good day. This is a $60 or $70 retail product. And people are giving it away for free. And I have heard that so many times.
Is there something in the part of, because you're big on community, as we'll get to in a minute here. And I know that on the counterfeit, I think, you know, one of the things I thought about was like, how do you keep this? Counterfeiting has to be a huge issue. And I believe you mentioned in other interviews, the thing that protects you against that is the community and the brand loyalty you've built up. Is that giving the gift? Is that part of something that, is that part of kind of the spike ball community or culture or ethos? Or like, I agree, that seems, even if I have a great time with somebody, a couple hours, chances are I'm not going to give them my $70 kit. So why does that happen?
One of our values at Spikeball is surprise and delight. Now, we are public with our values, but we don't, I think, shout them from the mountaintop. So if we were somehow able to find every person that's given away a set and ask them, were you aware that one of Spikeball's values is surprise and delight? I'm assuming the answer is no. But there is something about our community that, you know, like if you come to any of our tournaments, it's primarily young guys, you know, probably 80% guys, 20% women. Most of them are in their 20s. And they're competing and they really want to win. But you rarely hear any disagreements. You don't hear anybody like getting nasty with the other. Like, everybody's like so chill with each other. Part of that might be because it's a self-officiated game. You know, you kind of need to stay cool with your opponent. But it's been incredible to see just how welcoming, how open, how generous the community has been. And yeah, I mean, you know, Warren Buffett likes to talk about, he only likes to invest in companies that have protective moats, or has that moat that can't be copied. Ours is the community. It's not our rubber ball. It's not our plastic net. It is the community that can't be bought. That has to be cultivated over years. So yeah, I mean, I go to a decent amount of tournaments and I get to meet people and hear what's going on in life. And yeah, it's been, and when I started the company, I never thought any of this would happen. I thought if I was lucky, somebody would give me their $50, I'd ship them a box, and that's literally it. Like, cold hard transaction, we are done. In those first 5 years, you could only buy it on spikeball.com. So literally 100% of our revenue was there. And the beauty of that was I was able to email every single customer. And I did. It was not an auto reply saying, thank you for buying. It was a hand-typed email from me saying, hey, Andrew, thanks for buying the spike ball set. I see you live in Tucson. What a great city. By the way, if you don't mind me asking, how'd you hear about spike ball? And that email, I don't know how many times I sent that. Majority of people ignored it, but a lot replied. And that, number one, told me where I could start marketing. You know, I was using a shotgun before, but once I got answers to those questions, I was able to start using a rifle. And relationships also happened. Like I've got some customers from 2008, 2009, I'm still in touch with.
You mentioned the early days, you were only selling on your .com. And I feel like it's funny watching kind of opinions and worldviews or maybe internet views kind of come and go. But I feel there's one right now that's like DTC is dead, right? Like if you have a .com, it's just dead. You have to go to Amazon, you have to go to retail, trying to sell direct on your own site. It's just not working. And I think, I don't buy that. I think maybe some of the old business models of leveraging cheap traffic to kind of quickly build a business, I think maybe those have gotten much more difficult. But I think if you still build something great and you have a long-term horizon, you're willing to invest in it over time, I think DTC can still work very well. So I'd love to get your thoughts on this. Like you have a really great brand, you have a very strong community. And you could, if you wanted to, you could sell just on your .com. I believe you sell on Amazon. I'm sure you sell in retail. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about that. Like, A, do you think DTC, just selling on your .com is a kind of a bygone business model that's going to be, you know, just kind of slowly going away, or is it going to be much harder? Or is it something that works really well for you? And also, how does Amazon and retail fit into that equation for you? Because they're all kind of interconnected.
Yep. So I'll start with that last part first. So put things in perspective. So spikeball.com used to be 100% of our revenue. It's now maybe 5%. It is tiny. So who are the big players in our world? Walmart, Target, Dick's Sporting Goods, Amazon, Canadian Tire, a bunch of brick and mortar retailers in Europe. Those are our big ones. And why is that? We've never had an in-house like e-commerce team. We've had a marketing team. We have a marketing team and they are doing amazing stuff, but none of them have come with a background in e-commerce. And it's something I've been wanting to do for years. I think we have tremendous potential. I think we can easily get spikeball.com to become a significant portion of our overall revenues if we had that in-house expertise. We'll get there someday, but if I have to choose between somebody that's a Facebook marketing expert or can optimize for the cheapest click or whatever, if I have to choose between that and somebody that's going to help me build long-term relationships and make sure the brand is a little bit stronger than it is today, I'm taking that second person all day long. And I think that kind of answers my question or your question on, you know, is the DTC model gone here or whatever. And I think as long as you're looking at it and trying to build a long-term thing and you're not, I think you called it like cheap traffic, I think those days are over. And some companies were able to, you know, hire that whole team to optimize, and did not think about that sort of long-term approach of, wait, how do we actually build something that people like and, you know, mean something to them? You know, we've got, you know, at a tournament in Paris this summer, a player in the middle of the match dropped to an ankle as if he had, or dropped to the ground on the grass as if he'd like twisted his ankle. Girlfriend comes running over to see if he's okay. He pulls a diamond ring out and proposes to her. In the middle of one of our tournaments, one of life's most special moments, he chose our tournament to do that. We have people that have been getting tattoos of our brands. We had another proposal where one woman dropped to her knee. She proposed to her girlfriend, and on the ball it said, I think, will you be my partner for life? There is no higher compliment to somebody that's creating a brand than something like that. You're not going to get that kind of stuff by being the world's greatest Facebook marketer. You're going to get it by treating people like humans and learning what they like and they don't like. And I'm not trying to rag on Facebook. Like there is a place for that. And you know, we literally just signed our first, this is our 14th, maybe 15th year of being in business. We just signed an agency like 2 weeks ago to help us with Facebook ads.
Hey, it's Andrew here with a quick aside. And you obviously love e-commerce. You're interested in that. And so I wanted to make sure you're aware of the private community we have at E-Commerce Fuel for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brand owners. And it's something we've been building for close to a decade now with over 1,100 members across the globe. And our secret sauce, like the name implies, is that everyone inside has deep experience doing this with an owner mindset. And so what does that mean? It means you get, when you log into our form, you get fast, on-point answers to your most pressing questions, regardless of whether that's you're negotiating a new lease for a warehouse, or maybe you're negotiating with UPS or USPS or FedEx about shipping rates or pickup times, or potentially you're just looking to find a great outsourcer, or wondering if you can even outsource your content. Is that something anyone has had success with? You can tap into this huge knowledge and brain trust across the globe and get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes. So it's an incredibly active form with experienced people. You get to plug into an amazing network worldwide. A lot of our members, when they travel, if they touch down in Dallas or Sydney or London or Bozeman, Montana, or whatever it is, oftentimes they'll reach out to other ECF members. You know, obviously a little harder to do potentially right now, but and see if, you know, they want to get together for a beer to connect and just, and oftentimes get to know a new friend. So it's an amazing network, as well as invites to our member-only events like ECF Live, which is our annual summit gathering for about 200 people. And then finally, the intelligence in our community just that's shared helps you avoid making really costly hiring and software mistakes. So our members write reviews on what they're using, their software tools, their agencies, completely unbiased, completely from their own experience. And so you can avoid making that, you know, hiring that agency that's an absolute nightmare, but you don't know about it. Or you can hone in on the one that actually does a really good job. It saves you a ton of time and money from bad hiring and software decisions. So if any of this sounds interesting, head on over to ecommercefuel.com and you can learn more about the community, what's included, and apply for membership as well. All right, let's go ahead and jump back in to the discussion. Kind of going back original, the DTC is dead. It's interesting, you know. So, I mean, on that front, you could say, hey, well, you built this brand. Maybe DTC isn't as powerful as you think, given that, you know, so much of your revenue comes from Amazon and retail. So if you had to pick between those two, if you could only sell through Amazon or only sell through retail, which one of those channels do you look at as more critical and valuable for your business?
I would not change the way I launched the business. You know, those first 5 years, yeah, you look at traditional sort of DTC, how, you know, definition, we were it. You could only buy there. I think maybe year four, I started adding little SMB retail stores, started reaching out to us and asking if they could carry us. And we eventually said yes. And if I didn't have those 5 years of .com sales, I never would have met any customers. And I never would have learned that ultimate frisbee players absolutely love spike ball. I never would have learned that PE teachers love it. So if I had gone to Amazon on day one, or if some miracle would have happened and I could have gotten Dick's Sporting Goods on day one, I would have had zero feedback, because those platforms, those retailers just don't share that with you. So if you're starting a business, whatever avenue keeps you closest to the customer, to where you can actually send them an email or pick up a phone and talk with them. If you can do that through Amazon or any other retail, then great, go for it. But if there's going to be this intermediary between you and the end user, then it's going to be really hard to learn who's buying the product, why'd they buy it, where are they going to be using this product, and is it for them? Is it a gift? And just whatever.
No, I totally get that. Like the early days in terms of the focus makes complete sense. But kind of, you know, late 2022, where you are right now, you've got Amazon on one hand, lots of people actively search there. It's captive demand, but you also have probably more, I'm guessing, more headaches and logistics with getting product in there, counterfeits, copy fake, you know, fakes, things like that. Whereas you look at wholesale, that's more of a, probably a cleaner business, I would guess, maybe more cash flow, maybe not. They're just different. They're different channels with different pros and cons on each one. So if there's someone out there right now thinking, hey, my .com's tough, I either need to go all in on Amazon or go all in on retail. And granted, some products are a better fit for one versus the other. But if you had to drop one of those two channels, if you could only have one of those two channels today as an established business, which one's more valuable to you net at the end of the day in terms of revenue, profitability, and also headache and hassle?
I'd probably say retailers. Amazon's been a weird bird since COVID. In 2020, outdoor recreation was the number one industry. We saw the biggest increase of any industry out there, whether you're making spike ball sets, tennis rackets, volleyball nets, swimming pools, whatever. So we exploded in 2020. And Amazon, and I understand why they did it, they limited storage limits for like non-essential items, I think so they could have like medical stuff in there and masks and all that. So we weren't allowed to store as much stuff in their warehouses. And that killed our sales. But Walmart and Target and all those guys kept calling saying, hey, we sold out, can we get more? So we started shifting more and more to them. And Amazon's made a few other changes over the last couple of years where it used to be way bigger for us than it is today. The one thing that a huge difference between the two is your cash flow cycle. So we're a third-party seller on Amazon, which means we don't sell our product to them. We actually sell on the platform. But we get paid like clockwork every 2 weeks, and it's a beautiful thing. Now, when you sell to Walmart, Target, or any of the other bigger retailers, it's usually net 60, net 75, and that's what's agreed to in the contract, but they'll pay late, and you'll call and say, where is it? And they'll be like, oh, we sent it, but I guess you didn't get it, so we'll cancel that check and we'll send another one. So they just bought themselves like another 10 days. The fact that some of these larger retailers are still, not all of them, but some of them are still sending paper checks, it's just so they can buy a couple extra days, before that check gets cashed. It's ridiculous, but I guess it makes sense. But wildly different cash flow cycles between Amazon and brick and mortar. And anybody that's making that decision, you need to really consider that. Like back in the early days when, spikeball.com was our big money maker, that's Shopify. So we get that money, 24, 36 hours. Dick's Sporting Goods called us and they said, hey, we'd love to, I think this is maybe in year six. They called up and said, hey, we'd love to carry your product. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe they actually called us. And we eventually went with them. And I didn't really consider the difference in cash flow cycles. And thankfully, I went to this like startup class where we talked about some finance stuff and everybody had to bring their P&Ls and balance sheets and everything. And the instructor looked at my numbers and he said, you realize you're going to run out of cash in about 4 months. Like, what are you talking about? We're going to like grow 300% this year. It's like, you realize companies can go out of business from growing too fast, right? And I didn't. So thank God I was at that class and he was able to let me know like, yeah, Chris, you're used to be getting paid every 2 days on this Shopify stuff. Dix is going to pay you every 60 and you have to pay the factory way ahead of time.
Have you financed the growth? So you have a really good bank. How have you financed that?
Yeah, we've got line of credit and kind of a traditional revolving line of credit with the bank. And we've been pretty smart with that. This last year or two has been a bit tricky, but yeah, we learned that if we want to take these big orders from these massive retailers, we couldn't do it on our own. We need it, because the factories need to be paid way ahead of the time that we'd get paid from the end customer. So it's taken some figuring out to make sure we do that in a smart fashion.
Got it. So net, end of the day, though, if you had to pick one between being in retail and being in Amazon, you'd probably keep Amazon and kill the retail side if you had to pick between the two.
No, flip that. I'd keep retail, meaning Walmart, Target, et cetera, and drop Amazon.
Got it. I'd love to ask you too about the last 3 or 4 months, maybe even the last 6 months, because it's been a rough 3 or 4 years for e-commerce in general, I think. And the last year has been challenging for its own reasons, partially with a lot of Facebook stuff and just online traffic and also a slowdown. But there's a lot of noise in there. And you have a brand that I think is really unique in that you're not focused a lot on paid traffic. You've got Amazon, you've got a little .com, you've got a retail side or the wholesale and retail side of things. So you're somewhat diversified there. So maybe less noise there. I'd love to hear if you're willing to share, how's the last 6 months been? Have you guys seen a pretty big softening in demand historically? Maybe that looks like a decline or maybe even just softening growth year over year. How are things looking just on the general health of the business in terms of how it reflects just kind of economic conditions and spending and just the business climate in general? What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's been a tough year. We are still trying to figure out sort of what our new norm is. So, you know, we went into 2020 thinking we were going to grow maybe 12, 15%. And that was kind of what we had been doing in the years leading up to that. That was kind of our comfort zone. And we wound up nearly doubling that year. And last year we grew, I don't know, another 10% on top of that. And this year, not going to happen. And we are talking to, you know, of course we talk to the retailers and, you know, other customers, and they're saying, yeah, we've got too much inventory. And the reason they've got too much inventory is because they ordered a bunch thinking 2022 was going to be yet another year of all charts being up and to the right. And, you know, come April/May is when consumer spending habits just shifted like overnight. You see some of the interviews with Target CEO back then. Yeah, he's like, yeah, we're going to need to write down $1 billion due to this, or we have never seen consumer spending habits change faster than. So everybody got the forecast wrong. So everybody's sitting on tons of inventory right now and isn't quite sure what to do with it. So holidays are always a huge season for us. So, you know, getting ready to ramp up for that. So hoping that we're going to have a great holiday. But, you know, it's been a tough year. We had to do layoffs this summer. We had 50 people. We had to lay off about 10, and, you know, been cutting as much as we can. Now, the beautiful thing is the retailers and everybody else tells us, look, this is not a spike ball problem. Like, the consumer still absolutely loves you. This is something we're dealing with every product in our store. So when we go to our tournaments, there's still tons of people coming to the tournaments. When we see just kind of how people engage with us on social media and our email and SMS, et cetera, it's never been stronger. There's, though, these economic headwinds and just things happening in the world, like Ukraine, inflation, et cetera, that are doing a major shift. And the way, what we're learning is the retailers, what they're choosing as the way to measure the health of the business is, are we at or above 2019 levels? Yeah, that was the last, quote, normal year before COVID. And if you're not at that level, then okay, something's wrong. But thankfully, we are still significantly above 2019 levels. So none of the retailers and nobody's saying like, look, this is a spike ball problem and everything else is great. So we're trying to figure out like, okay, how can we be as smart with our cash as we can? How can we really up our forecasting abilities? Now, you know, we're a company of 40 people. We, of course, don't have an entire forecasting team. So, you know, if Walmart even got the forecasts that far off, or Dick's or Target or anybody, I'm not entirely sure how we're going to try and get it right. But, you know, what's 2023 going to look like? And we can argue, okay, are we in a recession today? Maybe, maybe not. But I have yet to see a single headline of somebody saying, oh, 2023 is going to be much better. Sounds like it's going to keep getting worse. So we're trying to plan for that. And the frustrating thing is like, okay, we have to, you know, cut budgets and slow everything down. At the exact same time, we have so much opportunity. It's just driving me crazy that I can't go after all of it. So many things that just, so many fires burning that just need more gas on them. And we just don't have that gas right now.
Yeah, well, appreciate the honest, candid take on the last 6 months. It's been a struggle for a lot of people out there. So appreciate the kind of look into the business on that side. Man, if I had you for longer, I'd want to do like a 45-minute deep dive into retail and getting into, you know, retailers and talk about how you built the community more. I was hoping to get into that, but just didn't get into it. So would feel guilty stealing up 3 or 4 hours of your day. So this has been a ton of fun. Thank you for coming on and doing this. And if you're up for it, I'd love to cap this off with a quick lightning round. So feel free to just answer these, you know, 1 to 2 sentences or, you know, as short as you can on the replies, but let's cap it off with that. So first one is, what's one of the fondest memories from your childhood?
Playing hockey on a frozen river not far from my house.
Favorite sport that's not spike ball?
Tennis.
Hardest part of your business?
Finances.
How much money is in the bank is enough? This is kind of a recurring question on the show. So money in the bank, a dollar amount that if you had that, you know, if you made more money in your life, that'd be great. But if you didn't, that'd be okay too. So what would that dollar figure be?
In my personal bank account?
Yep, personal bank account, not business bank account.
Oh, geez. I get in this disagreement with my COO often. He's very goal-oriented and has very clear goals, and he has a, quote, number, and it drives him crazy that I don't. And I'm like, yeah, I just don't think that way, and I try to focus on doing whatever every day. I don't have that big long-term, so I am going to dodge this question. I don't know what that number is.
Got it. Let me push you because I get people dodge it a lot, and it's also a tradition of the show where I push back a little bit. What would be either a number or maybe even an income, like an annual income that you'd feel like this is plenty, this is good. What would that number be if it's not a net worth number in the bank? It's an annual income number.
All right, I'll go back to the first question. First one, $10 million.
$10 million. Yeah. Nice. How many hours a week do you work?
I would guess it's between 40 and 50. It's not crazy. I've got, I think, a pretty good work-life balance for the most part.
Nice. Very cool. Number one hobby, and you can't say work or spike ball or tennis, since we've already heard those.
I do like to read a lot. So if I've got time on my own on weekends, you'll most likely find me sitting with a book somewhere.
And then finally, most interesting person you've met through either e-commerce fuel or more likely maybe, because I'm not plugged in the community as much, but maybe Twitter or entrepreneurial circles, just someone, a real interesting entrepreneur that you've connected with in those circles.
Jason Fried of Basecamp. So you know Jason, or do you know of him?
I know of him, yeah. I never talked to him, but I know of him.
Yeah, so he's a fellow Chicagoan / former Chicagoan. I love that the way he and David are building Basecamp is a huge challenge to the status quo of how you build a tech or a software business. You know, they didn't raise money. They're in it for the long haul. They're focused on building this business for the long haul and generating a profit, and kind of people may look at it as like an old school way of running a business, but doing that and being as wildly successful as they are, and Jason's always been very generous with his time, and we had an advisory board a few years back. He was on it, and great writer as well. They put out a couple books as well that I strongly recommend to people.
Yeah, he's got some great stuff out there. I've read it. Well, wonderful. Well, Chris, thank you so much. If you want to check it out, if by some crazy coincidence you have not, you're like, spike ball, trampolines, what is this all about? Spikeball.com. Head on over there, check it out. You can see you learn everything you want and watch some videos about it. It's a very cool sport. Of course, you can get it on Amazon or in probably your favorite retailer as well. So love what you've done, Chris. Love the philosophy behind the kind of the slow but steady march over the last, 15-ish plus or minus years. And really appreciate you coming on. This is fun. Thanks for making time to do it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great.
Given you've made it to the end of the episode, there's a pretty good chance you're fairly serious about this e-commerce stuff, which is why you should check out the E-Commerce Fuel community. It's a vetted, vibrant community for 7- and 8-figure brand owners. And joining gives you access to a lively discussion forum for experienced founders sharing insights and getting help, access to our library of over 20,000 member reviews on everything from agencies to tech to lawyers to all the things that founders are making hiring decisions or purchasing decisions on to run their business, and invites to member events throughout the year. So if that sounds interesting, you can apply for membership and learn more at ecommercefuel.com. Big thanks to One-Click Upsell from Zipify Apps. Rapidly increase your AOV by offering targeted high-converting upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And also to Fulfill.io, an ERP designed specifically to streamline complex e-commerce businesses and the highest rated ERP among our community members. Learn more at ecommercefuel.com/fulfill. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
The ASY Radio Network, live from New York.